Good evening. My name is Mac Brewster, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here, and especially see Barbara here. It's a gift. Thank you, Barbara. Frank. I've been to Palm Springs in quite a while. When we came down through the valley, all those new windmills. I hadn't seen so many when I was here before. And I thought, my God, Palm Springs is, the area down here is really changing. And then I walked down the hall last night, and I didn't know there was another convention going on here. And I'm walking along, and I'm reading these things, and it's talking about sin and the devil, and I thought, oh, Lord, boy, it has changed down here. And then, yeah. Somebody told me, so that's a different group, you know. I was really glad. Yeah. I told a joke there at the table a while ago, and it came out so good I thought I'd tell it again, you know. But my wife's Murphy, and we went to Ireland one time in a little town in Wexford. Everybody's a Murphy there. But this joke is about a mean little Irish kid named Michael Murphy. And he went to his dad, and he's about 7 years old, and he says, I want a bike for Christmas. And his dad says, I'm not buying you nothing. Mean as you are, you don't get nothing. So you want something, you write a letter to God and ask him to give it to you. So Michael went and sat down at a table, and he got a piece of paper. He said, Dear God, this is Michael Murphy. I want a bike for Christmas. And if you'll give me the bike, I'll be good for 2 years. And then he looked at it, and he signed it, and he looked at it, and he said, Oh, God, 2 years, long time. So he tore it up, and he wrote, Dear God, this is Michael Murphy. I want a bike for Christmas. If you'll get it to me, I'll be good for 2 weeks. And he looked at it too long. He tore it up, and he looked up on the shelf, and there's a statue there of the Virgin Mary. So he went over and he got it down, and he wiped it off real good, and he went in the closet and got a box, shoe box, brought it out, and he put the statue in, covered up some tissue, put a lid on it, put it in the back of the closet. It's going to be good, I can tell. So then he sat down and he said, Dear God, this is Michael Murphy. I want a bike for Christmas. And if you don't get me one, you'll never see your mother again. You know, last 20 years of my drinking, I never heard that much laughter in the whole damn time. It just really wasn't a hell of a lot to laugh about when I got here. I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was brought here by a total stranger on June the 15th, 1966. And through the grace of a loving God, the 12 steps I feel that helped me find my way. I'm a product of those 12 steps. But through the program here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found it necessary to drink any alcohol, go to jail, live the way I used to live. For that, I'm very, very grateful. And I'd like to share with you here today some of the things that happened that helped me get here and stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in a flop house on Anaheim Street in Wilmington, California. Now, I don't know if anybody here knows where Wilmington is or not. See a couple of heads, yeah. Most people don't know where it is. And if they ask me, I tell them it's a little resort area on the way to Catalina. You know? Now, if you laugh, you've been there, you know. And if you haven't been, don't go, you know. There's nothing there, really. But I was vacationing down there. And It's, I don't know what time it was or what. I didn't pay much difference to time when I was drinking like that. But I'd been on about 6 weeks drunk, and somebody was pounding on a door. And I came to and let them in. And what I remember about that day is really weird, because when I opened the door, it was a 16-year-old daughter of mine that was standing there. She came in the room, and I remember that she just attacked me. She started asking me all these questions, and they were trick questions, like, why aren't you working, you know? Yeah, and why aren't you paying my grandmother the money you owe her? And just questions like that. And the only answer I had to any of those questions that she was asking me that day, I poured out of a glass. I poured a water glass out of a bottle into a glass, and I poured a water glass full of whiskey, and I tried to drink it, and I got it in my mouth, and I couldn't swallow it. Now, normally in a room full of alcoholics like this, that's not a big deal. It wasn't for me. I'd had a lot of days when I couldn't get a drink down or you know, had trouble getting it down, so it wasn't a big deal. Most of us know that if you work at it, get down to business, pretty soon you'll get one down, you know? And then after a period of time, maybe you get one down that stays down. And then you got the show on the road and away we go again. But that day it just didn't seem to be coming down that way. Now, that daughter of mine only stayed in there a couple of minutes. And seemed to me like she's in there for much longer. But she said something before she left. She said, you know, as I came in, I noticed some chairs beside the building. And the sun's shining out there. She said, why don't you go out beside this building, sit down in the sun, and see what you're doing to everybody that cares about you and loves you. And she left. And that's what I remember. I talked to my daughter, Dodie, about that sin. She has a different view about what happened, but that's what I remember. And I'm sitting out there beside the building. I got my water glass full of whiskey. I get it up in my mouth, and I was shaking so bad. You couldn't believe the way I used to shake when I came down off of a big drunk. And I was shaking real bad, and I'm holding that drink, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And all of a sudden, a guy came up, and he sat down next to me. He had a coffee cup in his hand. He's a big man, had his shirt off, he had two big eagles tattooed on his chest. And you know, I thought about it later. I was shaking so bad that day, it looked like those eagles were flying, you know? That guy, and I'm having a terrible time getting this drink down. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons was that I made a terrible mistake one time, and I ended up in the Marine Corps. And that's not a very good place to be if you got a problem with authority, you know? Anyway, while I was in there, time came by one time that I had been drinking all day really hard, and I had to go out and do some guard duty that night. And I was frightened because I knew if I went out there in the condition I was in, I'd go to sleep. If I drank anymore, I'd pass out. It's a real alcoholic's dilemma is what it was. And a guy came over to me, and he had a little white tablet. He broke it in two. He gave me half of it. He told me, drink some coffee. And he said, now, Mac, you go out there and you guard, do your guard duty. You'll be all right. You'll stay awake. You'll be able to guard. You know, I did. I went out there and I guarded that night. 3 days later, I'm still guarding things. You know? I'm guarding things that don't even need to be guarded. You know? And what that guy gave me was a half a Benny. He gave me a Benzedrine. And I thought I discovered a miracle drug. Man, for the next 10, 15 years, I drank whiskey, dropped Bennies, watch my heart beat through my shirt, you know. Just, they'll get you downtown. I lived in Wilmington at that time, and I'd go to San Pedro, and it's only 3.5 miles, and I'd drop some whites, drink some whiskey, and start to San Pedro, and I'd end up in Seattle, you know? I mean, those damn things get you going, and you just can't stop, you know, and away you go. I see a few heads shaking, you know, but it's true. But what they do, they give you the dry throat, too. When you come up after a few days of those things, your throat gets dry, and you know, just parched. So that was part of the reason I couldn't get that drink down. But they do a lot of other things, too. You make your hair hurt, you know, make your teeth itch and all kinds of things like that. But that was my dilemma that day. Now, there was another reason why I couldn't get the drink down, too. And a couple of years before I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking in a little town right in the middle of Long Beach, up on top of a hill that's called Signal Hill. I know a few people go like, used to be a hell of a watering hole up there. I mean, you go up there on a Friday afternoon with a pocket full of money, drink your way down the hill on the weekend. And a couple of years before I got here, I'm up there having fun, and I came to in a parking lot. Some guy just kicked my cheekbone here right through the roof of my mouth, broke my nose, kicked my ribs in. The guy really did a real number on me up there that day. He kicked me sober is what he did. And I came to, and I can talk about this, and I can taste it in my mouth, the taste of blood. And I'm literally choking on my own blood. And I couldn't get that bone pushed back up so I could move my tongue. And every time I tried to get my thumb in there, the guy kicked me again. And I could hear the sirens coming up the hill, people screaming and yelling, the taste of blood, all that fun stuff, you know. 3 days later, I'm sitting in a joint in Wilmington with some of my friends. I got a head like a watermelon, whole side of my head swelling, and we're drinking. And we're laughing about that. We're laughing like it happened to somebody else, you know? Yeah. That was me out there. That guy was kicking around like a football, you know? Somebody asked me, you gonna go back over and get that guy, Mac? And I said, hell no, I ain't going back over there. I may be an alcoholic, but I ain't dumb, you know? It's just the way it is. So that was another reason I get no air through my nose at all. You know, I've had my nose broke about 7 or 8 times. Got it broke after I got the AA. A guy hit me in the nose, broke it. So it just seemed like my nose is always getting out in front of me, you know. And, so anyway, I can't breathe, and that's another reason my throat was so dry that day. And I have to lubricate it and get it loosened up so I get some booze down. So I'm sitting there beside that building trying to get it, and this guy comes with his eagles flying on his chest. And he started talking to me. He had a big coffee cup in his hand. And he sat down, he pulled a chair up, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, I used to drink the way you drink. He said, I've seen you around town. I grew up in that town. He said, I've seen you around town here, around the docks all my life, all your life. And he says, I used to drink the way you drink. And I don't drink in that way anymore. Now, he didn't mention Alcoholics Anonymous, but finally he told me that if I would go back to that room and not drink anymore, that he would come and get me and take me to a place where I never had to have another drink as long as I lived, if I didn't want it. And what he did to me that day, he 12-stepped me out there beside that building. What he did, in a matter of a few minutes, he walked from my head right to my heart. I heard a guy say one day in a meeting that told a newcomer, he says, hang on to your chair because it's going to be a hell of a trip. And this same guy told him, no, he said, the trip you're going to take in AA is about this far, from your head to your heart. And that's where he walked me that day. I know he did, because if I'd have stayed there with my head, I would have shined him on. I'd have went on down the road and found somebody else. But he touched me. And he told me, so you go back to your room and I'll come and get you. I believed him. And maybe I was just at a point of where I had nobody else to lean on or look to. I went back to that room, and I waited. And I waited all day the next day, and nobody showed up. And I'm pacing, and I'm walking. Now, he didn't mention Alcoholics Anonymous, and he didn't tell me what time he's coming to get me. He just said, you go back to your room, and I'll come and get you tomorrow. And I was standing by the window looking out, and it's getting dark, and I'm panicked. And something came in that room during the day, and it was fear. Fear set in there with me, and I could have cut it with a knife. I was just frightened to death. And all of a sudden, there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and that guy was standing there. And I don't remember saying anything. I talked to him later about me, but I don't think we said anything. I just went with him. We walked down Anaheim Street in Wilmington a couple of blocks, and we turned on a street called Broad Street and went down to the docks. And we walked in the back of a union hall. And I sat down at a table with 10 guys. And I've heard people say they've been in AA years and never met anybody they drank with. Not true with me. I walked in there and I sat down at that table and I looked around. I knew everybody there. I didn't know it was an AA meeting, but I knew everybody there. There was a seaman there that I'd went to sea with when I was a kid. See, I grew up in Wilmington. I moved there when I was 13 years old, and I hustled the docks, and I worked around the docks, and I had a dream. I wanted to go to sea. It's in the middle of that Poplar War, and everybody's doing something, and I wanted to do my part. And I used to go in the Union Hall and talk to this guy about getting a ship, and he'd say, when you're 16, come and see me. And when I was almost 16, I went to see him, and he told me what I needed, some affidavits signed. So I got some forged affidavits, got them signed, and I went to San Francisco and went through maritime school. And I started going to sea. And I drank all over the world, drinking some of the finest watering holes there was, from Bourbon Street in New Orleans to Post Office Street in Galveston, Texas. San Pedro had one called Beacon Street, the Bank Cafe, and the Shanghai Reds, and some of the finest drinking spots. I drank in all of them. Alcohol wasn't a problem with me. I tell you, back then, alcohol was the answer to my problem. I was on a ship down in the South Pacific. I was 16 years old, sitting in the mess hall, drinking coffee, and a seaman came in. He said, hey, kid, you want to see something? Go look in the dirty linen locker. I went down and looked in the dirty linen locker, and laying in there in that dirty linen was a seaman. And he went through a convulsion. He ate his tongue about halfway up. He was laying there, and there was another seaman had a big leather wallet shoved in this guy's mouth to keep him from eating his tongue up. And I remember looking at that, and I went back to the mess hall, and I drank my coffee, and I said, that'll never happen to me. My only feelings about that guy was that he was awful stupid to get on that ship without enough booze to get him to where he's going. I thought, that's stupid to do something. I remember later in bars, I'd look over and I'd see some lady laying in a booth or some guy passed out across the end of a bar, and I'd say to myself, if I couldn't hold my whiskey better than that, I'd quit, you know? I'd quit if I couldn't do better than that. And that's the way I felt. I remember in AA, I heard a guy said he was hiding bottles when I first came. And I said, from who? You know? From who? I used to tell people point blank, if you don't like the way I'm drinking, get the hell away from me. And they did, you know? They did. I was 36 years old the day that Danny set me down out there beside that building. Few days short of 37, and drank up two wives and two homes out in Torrance. I started getting stuff before most people, or I started losing it before most people got it, you know? And I just drank up another wife and a home. And I had a dream, most young guys did, that I knew. And My dream was I wanted to become president of one of those locals. I saw the power that went on there, and I loved it. You know, I'd see a guy drive up in a big car and shut the ship down and go in the bar, and he'd tell the ship owner when he settles the problem, come over and I'll buy him a drink and we'll put everybody back to work. God, I love that kind of stuff. And when I was 29 years old, I ran for the first time for president of a longshore local, and I got it. I won it, and I was 29 years old. And I got it because of what I would do, not what I knew. And I'd built myself a reputation after the war was over, the Poplar War there. I went to work on the docks in Wilmington, and they had a few strikes, and I had a few opportunities to show them what I had. At that time, there's only two ways to get into there. You would marry into it, or you was born into it. And if you had those two things, you could get in. Otherwise, you had to fight your way in. And that's what I did. I fought my way in, and I became president of that local. Before Danny picked me up that day, 3.5 years I lasted on the job, those guys had voted me out. They went to San Francisco and had Harry Bridges take my job away from me. So if you'd have seen me a couple of days before Danny picked me up that day to take me to that meeting, I'd have been walking down Avalon Boulevard. And if I saw you coming and I knew you, I'd cross over the other side of the street, because I couldn't remember what kind of lie I told you the last time I saw you. And if you were in a car and you stopped and offered me a ride, I'd tell you that I'm just walking down to get my car out of the shop. Now, the bad part of that was they knew that I didn't have a car. And the real bad part was I knew that they knew, you know. So that's where I was at the day before Danny picked me up. And everybody was gone. There was nobody left but me anymore. I had nobody to blame anything on. So I went with this guy to that meeting, and we sat down there that night. And it was a few minutes before I realized it was an AA meeting. You know, the word alcoholic was a dirty word back in the 60s. You call one of the guys that I drank with an alcoholic, and he'd get up off the floor and knock you down, you know? I mean, I had a mother-in-law that used to call me an alcoholic, you know? But she called me a communist, too, so really didn't make any difference about her, you know? But I went with Danny, and we sat down in that meeting, and I don't remember too much, except there was one guy there, and he was drunk, and he was on the first ship I was ever on as a kid, and he was drunk then. He was drunk in that meeting that night, and he wanted to read out of this book they had. And I remember that they let Scotty read out of the book, and Scotty read for a couple of minutes, and then he started crying. He got on a crying jag. And I thought, you know, he keeps this up, they're going to throw him out of here, you know. And then after about 2 or 3 minutes of that, I think, I'll throw his ass out, you know. I didn't come here to hear somebody cry, you know. Things are bad enough without this, you know. And then somebody says, is there any alcoholics here? And I realized that it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous is I used to have a good drinking buddy. We went to the track together all the time. We played cards together. He was a good bartender, a good drinker. Journeyman drinker. One day he disappeared, never came back. And in the bar where we all drank, we opened that place up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Jerry never showed up anymore. So one day a guy came in, called us all down, said, you guys hear what happened to Jerry? We said, no, and he said he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember he said in a low voice like he died, you know? He said he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know that? This is the truth. After that, around the bar, anybody spoke about Jerry, They spoke in a low voice like he died. Yeah, poor old Jerry, you know. And that's all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a friend, he went there and he died, you know. That's on our way back from that meeting, I asked the guy, I said, what's this going to cost me? Yeah. And he said, well, in your case, I think what it's going to cost you, Mac, is if you find anything here and you don't share it, you'll probably lose it. Didn't make much sense at the time, does today. I see people come and find things here and they don't share it and they go off and they lose it, you know. And that's why I came down here today. That's why I got in the car with my wife and came down here yesterday, because I want to keep the things I found here. I sat in my little house in West Covina the other day and I played cards with my great-grandchildren, you know. One more drink and I could have missed all that, you know. One more lousy drink. Then he explained to me, going back to the room that night, he said, if you don't drink tonight or tomorrow, I'll come and get you and take you to a big meeting. There may be 20 people there. And he came and got me the next night, and he took me to the Salvation Army in Long Beach. And in an alley behind the Salvation Army, up on Pacific Coast Highway, there was an AA meeting. And that was my introduction into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you something, I wasn't impressed. But those guys in that union hall in Wilmington, they were impressed with me. I'll tell you how impressed they were. They were so impressed with me that they let me make coffee for them for the next 3.5 years. I became the coffee maker for the Broad Street meeting, and that became my job. And that was before stir foam. You know, you had to wash those cups, you know. And that was my job. And I stayed with that group, and they led me into Alcoholics Anonymous through the 12 steps. They told me there's a difference between being around the program and in the program. And they drug me right in. And every time I saw one of them, he'd say, are you, what step you working? And it just got old to me, because I, you know, I listen. I'm not an educated man, but I'm listening, I'm smart. And I heard him read out of this book that they read out of every time, and it said, these are only suggested steps. So one day one of them asked me, he said, what step you working? I said, I'm not working those steps. I said, it says right in my book, they're only suggested steps. And he said, yeah, but it's like a cop suggesting you get in the car, you know? And he led me on through that. You know? Then he explained to me, I told him, you know, you're talking about steps. I got the IRS after me. I owe them a ton of money. I got fired out of that union because I cooked their books and I took money that wasn't mine and I owe it. I owe my mother-in-law. I owe everybody in town. You're talking about steps. I don't need no steps. I need money. Money's what I need. And this one guy used to pat me on the shoulder and he says, kid, money ain't your problem. And I thought, what does he know, you know? What does he know? And they led me into the steps and they told me, I told them, I'm not writing anything and I'm not putting anything down on paper. I've been taught all my life, you do not put nothing down on paper. And my business is my business. My grandmother told me when I was growing up, you don't hang our laundry out in the goddamn street. You keep it right here. So you're going against everything I've been taught, you know. And they said, well, we got to clean you up. And the guy told me, he said, you know, I saw you when you came in, Mac. And I never forget the word he used. He said, shabby. He said, you look shabby when they brought you in. And I never really heard that word, but it stuck with me. He said, I saw you, and after about a week, you got some food on your stomach, and you got over those shakes, and you came in here, and you had your hair cut. He said, a few weeks later, you came in, you had some decent threads on, your shoes was shine. He said, it didn't take you long. You cleaned up the outside. He said, now what we're going to do with those 12 steps, we're going to give you a bath inside. The first time in your life, we're going to drag all that garbage out and look at it and put it where proper place. And I said, sound like you want to punish me, you know, for... He said, no, we're not going to punish him. We're going to free you. He says, there's a freedom here. And I thought, what could the freedom be for something like that? He says, well, he explained it like a station wagon. He said, all your life, you've been driving through your life in a station wagon. And all the crap that came up, you just throw it in the back of the station wagon. Keep on driving, you know. Said, you come flying in the AA, you slam on the brakes, and all that garbage comes forward at the same time. He says, now, if you be alcoholic like me, you'll drink when it comes forward. Without somebody with you and to help you and to show you, you'll drink. And he said, what? I said, well, you know, again, it sounds like you want to punish me again. He said, no, the freedom is here, Mac. When you pull all that crap out of that station wagon and start looking at it, you're going to find out that other people have been putting their crap in your station wagon, you know? You've been hauling around a lot of stuff, garbage inside, that ain't even yours. Maybe the people that told you it was the best thing they had going, but it's not true. So I took a bath inside. I worked the 12 steps. I had a spiritual experience of my own personal kind. I came and I came to believe. I was a guy that pushed my chair back when they prayed. I stood up one day and held hands with people in West Covina 5 years later. And I'll tell you something, we didn't hold hands on the dock even back then when we prayed. But when I went to West Covina, they had people that held hands and prayed. And I got up with them and I held hands. Through my experience with the 12 steps, I made those changes within myself. I met a red-headed Irish girl when I was up there. I was 10 years sober. And 1971, I got in a lot of trouble on the docks. And they sent word down that I was to move. And I cleaned everything up, and I went to West Covina, and they had a job for me in the city of industry. And I went to work for a large food company. For the next 7 years, I negotiated some of their contracts, or most of the labor contracts, against three or four other unions. And I did a good job. And then I met Kay in 76. Boy, 10 years ago. I was 10 years sober. I met her about my 10th birthday. And I'd swore off. I'd went through two bad marriages. And I couldn't stand the pain of that crap anymore. And then I met Kay, and I fell in love with her. And we've been together now for 29 years. And what a trip that's been, you know. What a trip. We have an Al-Anon and AA house. And I know today, I know as well as I'm standing here, that we wouldn't be together today. We wouldn't have the home, the harmony, and the stuff within our mixed family of two or three. She's been married a couple of times. I've been married. We got kids all scattered around. And there's harmony among all of them. And it's a direct result of putting two programs together, program of Al-Anon, the program of AA. I got fired. I got a call not too long ago from a guy that I'd taken out of a 12-step house 20-some-odd years ago, put to work for a large company, and he retired, and he called me up to thank me. And he said, you know, I really want to thank you, Mac. I never had a good job that had benefits and retirement and stuff till you got me this job. And I was real glad for the guy, real happy for him for a couple of minutes, and then I hung up, and then I thought, yeah, but they fired me, you know. I get him a job, he retires, I get fired. But that's the way it goes. I got an opportunity to go back to school. I'd been to school since I was a real young kid. And I went back to school and I ended up in the mortgage business. And I ended up at a time when rates were like 15%, you know, instead of what we got today. It's tough. I got a P pension trust fund to a company that thought enough of me to give me their pension trust fund out of Bank of America. And I funded loans back then when things were tough and the interest rates was high, good rates. Made some money, had some fun. And me and Kay started going to AA and Al-Anon together, and we started traveling, and it was great. It's been great. It's been a hell of a trip. And again, one more drink and I could have missed it, I know, you know. Just one more lousy night out there in that jungle having fun, I could have missed this whole thing. I came to believe that AA works, and it works good, just the way it was the day I came in here 38 years ago. And I try to keep it the same as it was when they gave it to me. I have some real good friends, Frank and Barbara, here tonight, and I have some other friends here sitting at the table, and they have children like I've got, and I got a grandson just went back to the penitentiary the other day. It was three of his kids that was sitting at my table playing cards with me the other day. Sad story. Kid's been around AA all his life, and he just doesn't want what we have. And it's a sad story. But I was taught this, and then I'm going to sit down and let Kay talk. I was taught this here, and I believe it just as good as it was the day I came in here and was taught. AA is not going to solve all your problems. Al-Anon is not going to solve all your problems. AA and Al-Anon will let you live clean and sober one day at a time with unsolved problems. And that's what happened here to me. They let me live one day at a time with unsolved problems. I've been given a gift here. And I believe that I walked around with a cloud, dark cloud over my head half of my life. And I believe that AA put an umbrella over me. And things have been going not always great, but good. I love you, and I really thank you for inviting me and Kay down. I've had a wonderful time renewing some old friendships here and just being here among you guys in the desert. And I'm sure glad that wasn't your litter tour across the hall. Thank you.
Asked me while her husband was speaking, how long is our program? And I wrote her a little note and said, well, I can't find anything on the program scheduled until 6 p.m. It's the banquet. And she says, oh, Lord, don't let him talk that long. That wasn't quite what she said. But it is my great pleasure now to introduce Kay.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kay Brewster, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Do you think that alcoholic of mine's been hanging around with me too long? He's a good Southern Baptist, and he's up here at the podium telling Catholic jokes. Think I have anything to worry about? I second what Max said. It's a real honor to be asked to come down here and share with you here at the Mad Dog Days. I want to thank the committee for extending the invitation. And it's wonderful to be, like Max said, in the company of all of our friends, those that we have known for a long time and those that will become new friends on the other side of this afternoon. You know, I am also a graduate, or not a graduate, but a beginner. 1975 is a good year, Mr. Joe. And when I sat in the meeting last night and heard our opening speaker, Joe, I thought, 1975, I wasn't planning on staying here 29 minutes, let alone 29 years. It's just been a miracle like so many in our combined fellowships. It's an astounding thing when we look back and see how a meeting at a time, how much time has passed. I want to tell you briefly, very briefly, about my family and where I come from, but I, more importantly, is what I do these days. And you know, the longer that I'm around, I see a tremendous amount of people. I was talking with my sponsor this morning, tremendous amount of people that the lights have dimmed in their eyes, that their energy level toward how excited they are about being in a program of recovery has dimmed some. A lot of people are stuck. A lot of people aren't excited about where they are and what they have to look forward to. And I don't stay any place where I'm not excited about what I'm doing and what's being offered. And I have never lost, and I'm so grateful for this, the excitement about the potential in a program of recovery. I've been very, very difficult many, many times to sponsor, to befriend, because of the depth of my fear and the depth of my soul sickness. But I have never, ever left. And that tells me a lot about the divine purpose that is in my life these days and has reigned there since I was brought, even in the face of my resistance and not wanting to be here. But I was born into an Irish Catholic family. I'm the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers. Same set of parents for both my brothers and myself. My brothers set goals, went to school, stayed in school, and are successful businessmen, husbands, members of their community today. And then there was me. And there was nothing that I did over a long period of time that necessarily pleased my folks. I was a real handful from the gate. I have my grandson with Mac and I and my our daughter this weekend. And our daughter, Stephanie, is 10 years clean and sober by God's grace. And but I saw this morning my grandson got bit by a red ant. And the drama that he brought into the bedroom, it was just a keen reminder why he was delivered to our family. And he had he went from being bit by one ant to four, Grammy. And then they had big mouths like a spider and big long teeth, and then he'd cry. He's just beautifully dramatic. He's a perfect boy, and I love him to the depth of my soul. But anyway, that's a little off what I was starting to talk about. My brothers and I, today we are all good friends, and I no longer sit wanting anything that they have, wanting the admiration that seemed to flow from my mother and dad so freely with them, and to be on more of a conditioned side with me. I always felt that if I did good things, then I deserved to be loved. And when I made amends to my folks, that's not how they saw it at all. My dad said, I had always loved you. And but that's the misperception that myself and so many of the rest of us operate with for so long before we get here. I was given a good education, certainly one that I was not appreciative of when I was in the midst of getting it, but today I stand before you deeply grateful that my mother and dad did what they did to give me a good foundation in life, a good education. I went to private school, and then I went to junior college, not because I wanted to further my education, because by this time I was looking far beyond the learned word. There was something out there that I needed to get, and I needed to get on the fast track and get it, and I found him in Spanish class, and he was about 6'2", and looked like a perfect candidate to me, and I did everything that I knew how to do to get this gentleman to be interested in me, and he fell for me hard, and we got married and moved to West Los Angeles, and he went to school, and I went to work. And I had a moment of clarity probably about a month, 6 weeks into our moving down there, and I thought, this doesn't seem to be right that I am working and he's going to school. And then when I came into Al-Anon, I professed not to know anything at all about what they were talking concerning control. And of course, I knew a lot about it. I'd put in a lifetime of controlling, and this was one of my very first episodes, is when I realized I was working and he was in school. That did not seem to be right, so I quit my job and went home, and when he came home, I told him that I'd quit my job, and it was time for him to go to work. And this was a nice guy from a nice home that never has to this very day understood how he got hooked up with me. You know, even after amends, and I mean, I've done all the stuff with this guy, and we have grandchildren and grandchildren together. When I enter the room, he takes several steps to one side. And this has been years later. And so I know that I did a tremendous amount of damage to him and scared him. I scared him to death. But I just always made moves, quick moves, and moves that would affect other people's lives. And you don't do that. That's not the way to, that's just not the way to do it. But that's the way I did it back then. So he quit school, he went to work, and we ended up having our family. I had children, I do want to say, for the ladies in the room, I had children for all the wrong reasons. My first baby was born perfect in every way, and we had playpens back then, and I put her in a playpen, and I put her there, not just because it was a piece of equipment and she belonged in there, but I put her in there because I didn't know what to do with her. I was having children because I believed it was something that you did. But I had no deep feeling about motherhood, about having children. And this is how much my higher power loved me back then even. He delivered another baby to this one, and they took care of one another. I thought that the deal was perfect. So they both went in the pen to take care of themselves. And I, you know, the things that I've come down here tonight and will tell you briefly, I'm not proud about a tremendous amount of my behavior before I was brought to recovery. But I will tell you, I'm personally free. I'm personally free of the guilt and the anguish of all my past living problems because I am a product of the 12 steps. The 12 steps work, and they work well. You heard Mac talk about that. They did equally as good a job with this Al-Anon member. And I had tremendous amount of guilt, not only concerning my children, but also concerning the fact that in my marriages I was not faithful. I was never faithful. It always seemed to be greener grass on the other side of the fence, and I would climb them and go partake and then have to try to distance myself from me so that I could live with me one more day based upon actions that I was taking and all the horrible effects of that. And, you know, Mac oftentimes talks about how he packed down the feelings and then he'd pour a drink inside to hold those feelings down. Well, I believe that my illness went directly to my soul. I didn't pour alcohol in on top of them to hold them down. I just pushed them down really, really deep, and they entered my soul. And I believe today that that is why I talk about my soul sickness. This marriage was doomed to failure, and it did fail, and I got married again. So I was brought into the fellowship having tried marriages. I had tried having children. I bargained with this God that when I was a kid, I had a simple concept of God. I used to climb trees, walk fences, and lay on the back of my swing set and pretend that I was in the circus. And I'd look up into the clouds, and that's where my God lived. And it was a simple, sweet concept of God. And when rules came along in the private education that I was being given, I couldn't equate. Nobody took a moment with me to talk about God and my perception of God and rules. And I put them all in together based upon the clergy that was feeding me the stuff. And I came away deciding that there was no room for me, all that I wanted to do, and God. So I laid God down. I laid the concept of God down. So when I came here, I was an atheist. I just didn't believe in God. I want to kind of hurry on here to what was happening to me when I was brought to Al-Anon. I was the crazy woman in the neighborhood. I moved around a lot. My second husband, we moved around a lot. So I identify with members of Alcoholics Anonymous that had geographical trips. You know, it was always well-meaning members of your family that would suggest another part of town might it might be different over there. Of course, nobody ever stopped to tell me that, you know, I took me with me, and if I was crazy in the south part of town, if I moved in the north part, eventually it would be the same way for me. And so I moved around a lot with my husbands, and a new part of town never, ever worked. But I thought I was, at this one time, that I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And I got very, very afraid. So my solution for that was that I would go to the community school and check in. I saw that they had classes for macrame and plaster of Paris. Now, I thought that that would calm me down. I was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I was spending a lot of time coordinating my cigarette holders. I used a cigarette holder, and I would coordinate them with the outfit that I had on. If I was wearing bright colors, I'd have a bright holder. If I was wearing pastels, I had a pastel holder. My first sponsor, when I came into the program, she said to me one time, "Kay, if you will put just 1 ounce of effort into working the 12 steps of recovery that you do to cleaning the filter, laying out your outfits, making sure that your holders match, you will have nothing to worry about as far as a successful future here in Al-Anon." And she used to say things like that to me all the time, and I thought she was mean and highly insensitive to my personal situation. But I'll get to her in a minute. So I thought I was having this nervous breakdown, and so I went to the class to learn how to do macrame and paint plaster of Paris. And it was God in his infinite wisdom in dealing with me always set the woman that was going to bring me to Al-Anon in my path at this school. And I ran into her, and she was drunk that day, and she couldn't find the room, and I was sober, and I couldn't find it either. So she said, I'll buy your lunch. I'll take you to lunch. And I hadn't allowed myself to be treated in a really nice way for a long time, so I thought that would be fun. And we went to a little dinner house, and she took me all the way to the back because that's where you all drink. You know, I found out that's where you always all were. It was in the back of the dinner houses. And it took a moment for the eyes to adjust, and we went all the way back, and she sat down, and she ordered her drinks, and I ordered a couple of Cokes, and we proceeded to talk. She told me all about her life, and it was very, very sad, and we cried together. And then she said, "And what about you?" And when Mac was talking about hard questions, now that was a hard question for me. What about me? I didn't know anything about me and what I was all about. And so I had to construct on the spot a story about me. And being Irish, that's not hard. It just takes you just... Usually if you're talking to an Irishman and you get them and they're a little scattered for a second, they'll just say, "Just give me a minute." And so I took my minute, and I constructed this story for Judy, and we sat there, and it must have been a good story, because we laughed some, and then she started to cry, and I started to cry too. And the stories had matched, and I felt that I'd done a good deal that day. And so then we left the dinner house, and we went back to the classes for a while, and then pretty soon she left, and then I left. Now, I was going to see Judy again, and I saw her in a grocery store one night when I ran over there. This is quite a while after that. Now, my living problems had progressed. I had progressed to where I was not bathing. I stand about 5'7½". I weighed about 85 pounds because I had ceased to eat. I was worrying about him. Now, I was married to a guy that would not mind. He not only did he drink, but he would not mind. And he wouldn't come home, and he wouldn't, you know, bring the money home. He wouldn't do anything. And on my side, I was cooking, and I'd leave all the dishes out on the table. I would just move the dishes with the dried food on them to the center of the table so that he could count the plates. I figured that he would count the plates to see how many nights in a row I had prepared dinner for him, that he had not come home. And I did laundry, and I left a lot of it in the garage, but a lot of it I brought in the house. It was thrown on the couch. I never folded it. I never had anybody to the house, so why did I need to have the furniture, you know, anything tidied up? I mean, I had just fallen. And then this was another thing when I was new, that I thought I didn't know anything at all about this victim thing that they were talking about. Self-victimization, I wonder what that's about. I wonder why they even waste time talking about that. Well, I had put in a lot of time honing that mantle for myself. Perfect. So so here I was at home in all this mess, and I ran out at night. Sometimes I had shoes on, sometimes I did not. Ran across the street into this grocery store. There was no sense in getting tidied up. Nobody was looking at me, and I was not interested in looking at any of you. And so I went to the grocery store and ran in and got what I was getting, and all of a sudden I heard someone call my name. And I ventured to look up, and I looked into the eyes of this gal that had gone to this little class with me. And Judy is her name, and Judy looked different this night. She did not look like the gal that I had left many, many months before. And what I did not know is that Judy had been gifted with sobriety, and she was now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not know that. She angled her basket. She was going on telling me something, and I could not hear. I was absolutely terrified. The fear rose in me, and I could not hear a thing. And all I knew was I had to get away from her and out of the grocery store. And I finally did do that, and just pushed the basket to the back of the store and ran out. Now, what Judy had said to me that night, among other things, she said, "I will come over and see you. I'll come and visit you." And I didn't think anything about that, because I wasn't worthy of a visit. So, you know, those kinds of things don't register when you've got no self-worth. And so it just went in one ear and right out the other. Well, a day or so later, Judy, who is now sober and knows how to keep her commitments, arrived at my front door. And I invited her in. I was raised with good manners. I invited her in, and I invited her in to the mess of the affected person, the person that has now been watching the alcoholic, not taking care of business. I had another baby by this time. I had bargained to God that if he gave me another baby, I'd take better care of this baby this time. The state of California had moved in and taken my other two through a series of events of which I was not faithful, and I got in a whole bunch of trouble. And the only women back then that were getting in trouble like me were alcoholic women. And so you're dear to my heart, and I to you, in matters about losing custody of your children. And so now I had this new baby, so I invited Judy into this house. And it was a mess, and she said to me, "I want to take you tonight to a place where I go, a meeting place where I go." And I said, "Oh, well, I can't possibly go," because now all of a sudden, all the mess that was evident, it was really apparent that I needed to clean it up. I needed not clean it up for myself or any other member of my family, but I needed to clear it up for Judy. She was my guest, and I should take a few minutes and tidy up for her. And she said, "I'll help you," and made a gesture to take off her jacket to help me. And then I immediately was filled with fear and guilt. I mean, I knew the kind of woman that I had become. However, I didn't want to deal with the truth of what I knew. I was embarrassed and humiliated, and I said, no, I'll go. And I only had one pantsuit that fit me back then, and I went and put it on and went with her. Now, why I went with her, I don't know. I have no idea why I went with her, except today I'll tell you that I believe that everything pertaining to my program has been divinely ordered. I totally believe that it's been divinely ordered. I just didn't happen to fall in here. Nothing in my life has happened by chance. It was all spiritually perfect from the gate. And I see that because I work with other people now. I have on-site experience from my living problems. And when I say I understand how you feel and I have been there, I am telling you the truth. I am credible these days. And I'm so grateful that I have been returned to that spot. Not that I had very much time before I came into the program to practice a lot of integrity, but I was raised in a family where a lot of that existed, and I turned my back on it because of my own severe neuroses and ran away from it all. So anyway, let's see, where was I with Judy? Oh, so Judy was taking me to this meeting. So we pull up in front of this club this night, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. What was it like? It was stupid. It was just stupid. You know, I mean, it was, everybody there was old and uninteresting, all about my age today. And, you know, when I was young and I had places to go, people to see, and I was just on a short detour here, and I needed to find out the people that were going to give me, I needed some money advice, and then I wanted to talk to somebody about automobile advice. I wanted to know where the people were, and the people just encouraged me to sit down, you know, and I didn't want to sit down, and it was hard for me to sit down, and I sat down in this meeting and proceeded to start on my path of recovery. I came quite a few months in a row, and then decided I would leave. I had memorized the 12 steps, and I'd waited for the person that was going to come in the meetings and listen to me recite them, and I believed I would sit in meetings and try to think which one they were going to sick on me to recite. And, of course, we all know that no one asks you to recite the 12 steps. And so I took that personally, and I left. I thought, they'll miss me when I'm gone. And, of course, I've always been very interested in myself and all things about me. And here I am in this meeting, and no one is interested, and so I leave. And then I came back, and the night that I came back was an important night. I sat out in the front of the club, and the meeting room was adjacent, and everyone came into the Monday night meeting. They were very excited to see me out there, and I was truly kind of excited to see them. I mean, I'm smart enough to know that loneliness is a terrible disease in itself, and I'd put myself on a pretty lonely trip, and I drug this little girl with me. I'd been hang gliding, and I'd been living in the back of vans, and I mean, my life had been very unhealthy, and I'm a grown woman with a child, and so, but anyway, that's just a whole other part, but anyway, here I am sitting in the front of the club, and they came in, and they said, were you coming to the meeting? And I said, oh, sure, and then pretty soon, the door closed to the meeting room. They had started their meeting. They were inside, and I was outside. And I believe that my higher power just had about enough. He had just had about enough out of me. I don't know who picked me up by the front of my shirt, but someone did, because I felt it. And all of a sudden, I found myself at the door of the meeting room. The door opened. I do not remember turning the knob and opening that door. It was everything that I wanted to do was to go out the front door, not in the meeting room. And now I'm sitting at the table, and the woman across the table reaches across and says, Kay, how are you? And I said, oh, I'm fine. I was always just fine. Whenever you'd ask me, just fine. Thank you for asking about me. I'm just fine. And the woman to my right-hand side said, Kay, glad to see you back. How are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm doing just great. And she said, you are a liar. And this gal had been watching me in and out and bounce around. And that night I did the very thing that I swore I would never do, because I'd been coming to meetings long enough to see people begin to cry and lose control of themselves. And I swore that will never happen to me. And I would judge you further, saying, pretty stupid. Never sit where they can get their hands on you and show that you have any feelings at all, or that you're not in tight emotional control, because that is a door swung wide open. And the minute that that happens, they get their hands on you, and then it's all over. So I swore that I would never, ever cry, and that night when she called me a liar, I started to cry, and as my higher power would have it. So that was an initial physical surrender for me, and I've cried many, many times since, many, many times. In fact, it's very cleansing to the soul. Tears are very good. And so here I was at the at this meeting. Now, I'm not going to go into any more details about the meetings, except I was sent to step study meetings. I was sent to participation meetings. I was just sent to meetings. And I asked this gal to be my sponsor, the one that called me a liar. I thought she had a lot of guts. So I thought, well, I'm supposed to have this special friend in here, so I'll ask her. So I did. And she said yes. And she became my sponsor. And she was sending me all over town going to meetings. And she would say things like, I want you to go over to this meeting. And I would say things like, don't you understand? I don't want to go to meetings. I don't like it here. Everybody seems old. Where do the young people go? I mean, where's the get in, get out click? I want to go to those meetings. And then I would answer her, and I'd say, oh, okay. Have you had those conversations? Oh, okay. When inside your head, you're screaming every excuse. Don't you see? Don't you understand? I did that for years around here. So God was working with me long before I made the real important spiritual surrender, where I began to address a power greater than myself. Because I would always scream inside all the objections, and out my mouth would come, oh, sure, I'd be happy to do that. So I was blessed with the gift of cooperation, even in the face of staunch resistance. And I believe that the most important thing for a person like me is coming to meetings. My first sponsor told me that. She said, above all, you come to meetings. I don't care if you're having a bad day, a good day, whether you're pleased with things or whether you're not pleased with things, you come to a meeting. It's taken you years to get here, and you're not immediately healed, and so every day you're dealing with your illness, every day you go to a meeting. And I minded her. I learned to cooperate, I learned to mind here, and I was going to meetings. Now, after 20 some odd years, I had my sponsor had events in her life that took her another direction, and she was not coming to meetings. And she had schooled me well. I was going to meetings. I was seeing her periodically. I mean, she had led me through the steps. I had written an initial in-depth four-step inventory. I did a yearly inventory. I mean, I followed direction, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that it was given. When Joe was talking last night, he said 100 times, if we were all paying attention, how grateful he was for the opportunities, even in the face of not knowing really what was going on or why the cooperation was there. Well, I was very much like that. I didn't know about it either. It's almost you feel kind of stupid sometimes when you think, was I that stupid that I didn't ever feel I had a choice, that I could say no, that I'd say, you know what, I don't feel good tonight. I have a headache. I'm going to go home. I never thought that. I stayed in meetings and sat in that chair. I was told to sit in that chair and go to that meeting. And by gosh, that's what I did. And I did it for years, over 20 years, this first sponsor. And I had gotten a little arrogant about sponsorship because there were other people who had to move on in sponsorship. And a lot of them had come and talked to me about it. And I got to feeling kind of cocky. Oh my gosh, I have never had to change sponsors. And isn't this wonderful? And I have this long-time relationship going on. Well, an event came, and it became time for me to take a look at the fact that I was not being sponsored. And so I thanked this woman and went my own direction for a while, scared my husband to death. That's called sponsoring yourself. And and he was just full of terror day after day after day. Until I came home one day and said, I've been to an Alathon, and I made a choice, and I've asked a gal to be my new sponsor. And so even after all of those years, I had been taught that sponsorship, I'm on a 5-point plan. My 5-point plan is I go to meetings, I am sponsored, I work the 12 steps, I work with others, and I am active in service. That's my 5-point plan. And there was one point of that was a little off kilter there. And I filled that with a new sponsor. And even though I'd been around for a long time, it immediately felt right. It immediately felt good. This woman goes to meetings. She has a nice relationship, a working relationship, certainly with her husband and family. Her relationship with her higher power is quite evident. She is exceedingly active in service. These are the points on which I need to concentrate and have someone break the way for me still these days. It works best with me. And I met my husband. I want to tell you briefly how I met Mac B. I'm really lucky. He's a grand, grand man. And I love him dearly. And he's a far better man than I deserve. And he's taught me a lot, and he's stayed with me while I've learned to grow up. I mean, he needs to be paid a lot of money for that. That he stayed still with me while I spent a lot. But anyway, he's taking good care of me. And I met Mac in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was there with my sponsor right beside me, and she said, we're going to the AA meetings because it's necessary, Kay, for you to hear that you were not on everybody else's mind. You've been on your mind for years. However, men and others in life didn't get up in the morning and say, gee, let's see how we can make Kay's life turn it upside down, just make her crazy. So I surrendered again, and off to the AA meeting I went with my sponsor. We were sitting there, and this one night this guy came in, and he was very much the kind of guy that I always looked at. He came in the back door, and he glad-handed all across the back, hit every newcomer back there, and then he had a choice of a side aisle, but he was a main aisle guy, and right up that main aisle he came, and I said to my sponsor, who is that guy? I like the looks of that guy. And she said, oh, well, his name is Mac. She said, but I would like to suggest to you that more importantly, you look at the very attractive blonde that is following him because they are an item. They're dating. And then I sat through the rest of that AA meeting that night trying to remember when I asked her her opinion about this blonde and whether they were, had I asked her about them? I couldn't remember. And but she volunteered the truth to me, like she always did, and I didn't pay any attention to it at all. We went after the meeting, we went to the little restaurant place, and Mac did the same thing in the restaurant that he did in the meeting. He hit every booth in the restaurant. I loved that. He came to our table, and I did the best 5 minutes worth of flirting that I'd ever done in my whole life. I was just on fire. I was magnificent this night. Because I wanted this guy, I liked this guy, and the blonde wasn't even in the picture. And so not too long after that, my flirting worked because he called me, and I was on my way out of town, and I went up there, but I was soon invited back by Mac, and we've lived together, and then we got married, and we've been together ever since. So it was a real gift. Mac's a real gift to me, and our relationship is definitely a gift from God. You know, I give him permission to Mac to not always like me every day, because I live with me every day. I know what it's like to live with myself. And so I give him permission on any given day not to like me. And in his own way, he's also given me permission to do the same. And that way we don't tamper with the respect and the love that we have for one another. We just don't tamper with that. He's always gets my respect and admiration for being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsors have told me, when all else fails and you don't like him, you don't love him, you don't agree with him, nothing's right that day, you get down to the fact that you respect the man because he is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what makes our relationship so energized and viable and full of such respect and integrity today. It's not because Mac and I know anything special at all, but we've just stayed the course. We've just stayed together, and we've stayed the course no matter what. You know, I made amends to my family through the 12 steps. Obviously, I'm no longer separated from any of them. Stephanie is here with us, and she gave us a tremendous amount of frightful times on her path while she was getting ready to get sober. And we're so grateful for her sobriety. And I'm grateful to the women in AA, because when her dad and I could not do it for her, she ran away from us. Thank goodness she had the sense to run away from us, which was seemingly something that I just didn't think I could draw breath behind. But she ran with her higher power down to Huntington Beach, and the women in AA took her in, and you did what was impossible for her mother and dad to do. That gift must be delivered through those who understand a gal like our Stephanie, and I'm so grateful to the women in AA. Quickly, my latest and biggest spiritual order. I still cry with this. Is regarding my mom, and you know, I didn't particularly like my mother. It wasn't that I didn't particularly like her. I did not like my mother ever. And we were in really big competition with one another. And she's a grand gal, but she and I just didn't ever really get along. And she tried to, her faith was very important to her. And the more she pushed the faith, the more I ran. And we just didn't ever click. My mom, I don't know, it's been quite a few years ago now, 15 maybe. And she was living by herself on her own, doing quite well, until we realized that she was had early dementia. She had early dementia for a while, and then it progressed to Alzheimer's disease. And Mac and I sat down. We had some long discussions about the fact that I wanted to bring my mother to our home. Mac said, I think that's good, but there was a lot more for he and I to talk about, that we would not lose our relationship in the caregiving that was going to be required here. And it was going to be progressive caregiving. It was going to be like the disease of alcoholism. It was going to get a lot worse and would never get better. And so we had a lot to talk about pertaining to he and I and the order at hand. And so Mac built his mother-in-law, a little mother-in-law place by our house to make my job easier. That's the kind of wonderful, generous man that I'm married to. And we brought mother home, and I took care and caregave for my mom for 10 years. And it was very difficult, and it grew more difficult as the days went on. And there was less opportunity for me to go to meetings, less opportunity for me to serve the fellowship that had saved my very life. And I did not like that. And I would get angry, and I'd get angry at the disease, and I'd get angry at my mama as the days grew more difficult for me to take care of her. And sometimes I'd come in the house, and I'd be crying at the back door and go to the bedroom. Mac would cut me a wide berth, and he'd talk to me later. Those are the sensitivities that are born out of families that are in recovery, that were well prepared for the events at hand and for the reactions and the effects that it's going to have of family members. And so my mom now has, the day came when we took my mother out to her new place in North Hollywood, and she lives in a nice place out there, a safe and secure place, the people that take care of her, love her deeply. I go out every week, drive out, and I want to tell you about my new sponsor and the suggestion that she gave me, which is one that has saved my very life in regards to my mom. I was looking around close. My brothers wanted the caregiving fell my way, and they wanted our mother to be out near me. And I struggled with that, and I went to my sponsor, and she said, you know, Kay, she said, just answer me this question. If you had your mother close, if you went to the grocery store, you went to a meeting, or you went shopping, and you were within a couple of blocks of your mother's place, and you did not stop, could you live with the guilt that you would have from that? And I said, no, I could not. And she said, then you seek a place where you have to drive to see your mother. And during that period of time, the only thing that's on your mind going is your mama. And the only thing coming back is your gratitude to God and your mom. And I like the way that that sounded. I like the way that that felt. And that's the reason that I decided on North Hollywood. So I drive out there every week expecting a gift. And my mother has been the blessed conduit of so many lessons from my higher power. My mom and I, when she was of sane mind, she and I couldn't ever connect. And these days, I tidy her hair, and I hold her hands. I hold her. We never touched in our family. We were not a family that told one another that we loved one another either. I tell her every day, you're so beautiful, and I love you, Mama. And I say it out loud, and I buy her red blouses and pink blouses because she said redheads never wear red, and they never wear pink. My mama doesn't know now. She looks so pretty. In red blouses and pink blouses. It's just lovely. And she doesn't know. And I tell her how beautiful she is. And so you have been a very kind audience today. And I just want to say that, you know, I'm no longer separated from members of my community, from my family, from the God of my understanding, because of your generosity in loving and accepting me. May God continue to bless all of you. Thank you very much.